वाक्यार्थश्च विचार्यताम् श्रुतिशिरः पक्षसमाश्रीयताम् दुस्तर्कात् सुविरम्यताम् श्रुतिमतः तर्कोऽनुसन्धीयताम् ब्रह्मास्मीति विभाव्यताम् अहरहः गर्वपरित्यज्यताम् देहेऽहमिति रुज्यताम् बुधजनैः वातपरित्यज्यताम्. So in this third shloka, the Acharya, he briefly mentions about Shravanam and Mananam and also Nididhyasana. So the first line that deals with Shravanam, the second line deals with Mananam, and the third line talks about the Nididhyasana. And the Upanishad statement, it does not convey the teaching explicitly or directly. That is always the Upanishad, the way it communicates. They are all normally locked up. They are not explicit. With the regular knowledge of Sanskrit and grammar and dictionary and all, one cannot decipher Vedanta. Therefore, in the tradition, there is a special discipline developed to understand the Vedantic teaching and a special key to open the Vedic and Vedantic teaching. And this particular branch of Vedic science is especially developed to extract the meaning of the Veda mantras. That is called the Mimamsa Shastra, which we can call it as the key to the Vedas. And without this key, Vedas will appear meaningful, meaningless, and it may be illogical, may be blabbering. It may be logically not very sound. All those things might happen. So, for example, we can take a few examples. A lot of examples are there in the Upanishads and elsewhere. There is an Upanishad called the Kaivalya Upanishad. And there is an expression in one particular shloka. The Upanishad says, Yetasmat jayate pranaha manaha sarvendriyani cha kham vayuhu jyotihi apaha prithvi vishvasya dharini. There is one statement like that. So, what it says, from Brahman, the Pancha Bhutas, all the elements, all the Jnanendriyas, Karmendriyas, Prana, they are all born. That is what this statement says. This is one statement of the Upanishad. Then naturally what we will think, all these things are all born out of Brahman. That's what we will think. They are all in front of us. They are all born out of Brahman. But the Upanishad makes a very strange conclusion. And it says, all these things are born out of Brahman and therefore they are all not there. It's so strange. They are all born out of Brahman and therefore they are all not there. This is a statement in the Upanishad. For example, if there is a baby born and you go to their house, you will see the baby there. Baby will be there. Can we say a baby is born and therefore the baby will not be there? It looks so funny. But that is what the Upanishad says later in the other shloka. Na bhumi rapo na cha vanni rasti na cha anilaha mesti na chambaran cha. That is the statement. And where you see, with our Sanskrit knowledge alone, if you want to translate this, we will conclude that the rishis were, perhaps they had nothing to do or they were unemployed. They had all the time to talk, lot of blabber. So they blabbered something. It says all these things are na bhumihi, apaha, anilaha, so vannihi, none of those things are there. Therefore, that's what it says. So, and we are also trying to foolishly preserve such teaching. You know, we are having Ganaparayanam, this, that and all, doing with these mantras which are meaningless. That's what we will conclude. This will be the conclusion of most of the people. And so we should never take the analysis of such people unless they also come under the sampradaya learning. Unless a person who is a Shrotriya and a Brahmanishta, a person who was also a student once, and from him only if it comes, then we can take. There are also another example. Satyam Jnanam Anantam Brahma. Brahman is Anantam, limitless, all-pervading. These are all statements. And the Upanishad says that the Brahman created all the world, all the bodies, all the minds. And then what did the Brahman do? Brahman entered into them. Tatrishtva tadeva anupravishate, Taittiriya Upanishad says. Now, what did it say in the beginning? If that is forgotten, no problem. But it is said that Brahman is all-pervading. If Brahman is all-pervading, how can that Brahman enter into something? For example, I can enter in the hall because I am not all-pervading. I am outside, and so I can enter into the hall. But if Brahman is all-pervading, it is already in the hall also, then how can Brahman enter the hall? Can Brahman enter into anything at all for that matter? But the Shruti very loudly says, Tadevanu Pravishate. That's what it says. So we will find any amount of reasoning we apply, all kinds of grammar, whatever we apply, we will never be able to understand such statements at all, unless we go to the Mimamsa approach. So that is the approach they give us to understand such statements. And that is what Shankaracharya does in his Anupravesha Shruti Bhashyam. That is the commentary on this Anupravesha Shruti. And in that commentary, this is what he approaches. And what is the method of Shankaracharya? Mimamsa only. And in this Mimamsa method, what does he do? Whenever a word or a sentence is not clear, to get the clear meaning, you don't go to more and more grammar or any of those things. It will never help. You don't go to more and more of Tarka Sastram also. That will not help also. When a statement is vague, you have to arrive at the proper meaning by taking into account all other statements of the Upanishad. That is the only way. So the answer to the question is not to be found outside the Upanishad, but should be found out within the Upanishad itself. So how it is said here, how it is said there, etc. Connect all of them, and that is called Samanvaya or Mimamsa. That's what they do. So we have to tie all those statements, and then we will find that each statement has got a beautiful meaning, a fantastic revelation. You know how much a person should be knowledgeable. When Adi Shankaracharya wrote the Bhashyas for all these Brahma Sutras and Ra, the amount of quotations he gives from so many places, it is unbelievable. So it is like a number lock system, we can say. The lock and key are both in the same system only and not outside the system. Similarly, the answer for the Upanishad is within the Upanishad only. We have to know how to arrive at the meaning. That is where our expertise lies. Also, like a jigsaw puzzle, all the bits are in front of us. The puzzle also is in front. The solution also is in front in those pieces. Only we have to rearrange to get the actual puzzle solved. And for the Mimamsa method of analysis, we talk about normally six factors called Shadlingas. Is another term, Shadlingas, and Upakramadi Shadlingas. So Tatparya Niranayaha, Mimamsa, and Atava Shravanam, all these things. So Upakramadi Shadlingaihi, by using the proper factors, you tie together all the Upanishadic statements to arrive at the proper meaning. This is called the Shravanam or Mimamsa. And that is what he says here. Acharya says, Vakyarthascha Vicharyatam. May you analyze the meaning of every statement, Vakyartha, especially the Mahavakyartha. And when you analyze that, Shrutishira Pakshaha Samashriyatam. May you stick to the statements of the Upanishad, Shrutishiraha. We already told in the last webinar itself, the Upanishads, like the head of the entire Shruti. Samashriyatam, may you stick to those statements. Don't go outside. You may not get anything outside at all. Don't try to apply all Einstein's theory and all that thing, relativity. You cannot apply any of those things here. Don't go to any other Shastram. Upanishad Shastram itself gives enough clues to extract the meaning from the Upanishad statements. So without going anywhere else, Shruti Shira Pakshaha, may you stick to the teaching of the Shruti Shiras itself. Here, Shruti Shira Pakshaha is one word, no gap in between them. So we should understand that how the words are coined. So Shruti Shiraha means Vedanta, that we told in the last webinar itself. May you always be on the side of Vedanta and don't get out of that groove at all. And this is Shravana. This is called Shravanam, also known by various other names, Vedanta Vicharaha, Vedanta Mimamsaha, Vedanta Tatparya Nirnayaha. There are so many words to describe this thing. And by the Shravanam, what is the teaching you arrive at? the essence of Jivatma is Chit, that is, consciousness is the essence of the individual, and the essence of the world is Sat or existence, and the consciousness and existence are both one and the same. That is, the essence of the individual and the essence of the world are one and the same. This alone we call it Sat Chit Atma. This is how we have to arrive at all this. So this alone we call it as Jivatma Paramatma Aikyam, the oneness of Jivatma and Paramatma. Then the next is the Mananam, which is introduced in the second line. So Shravanam gives us this particular information that Jivatma and Paramatma are one. And the second line gives the Mananam. Mananam is introduced here. Mananam is what? Mananam is logically refuting all other systems of philosophy which are contrary to the Vedantic teaching. Whatever is contrary to the Vedantic teaching, they are all discounted. So Vedanta Viruddha Darshana Nishedaha, that is called Mananam, negation of all systems other than Vedanta. Because any knowledge, if you take, that involves two parts. One is seeing the rightness of the right, and equally important is also to see the wrongness of the wrong. We should not only know the rightness of the right, we should also know the wrongness of the wrong. It is not enough if you know only the right alone. By knowing the right alone, we cannot call our knowledge as a firm knowledge. We may know we have the knowledge, but we won't say it's a firm knowledge, because if you have not, for example, seen the fallacy of the wrong notion, one day or the other, the wrong idea may appear as right. That is why we find sometimes, for example, that we inquire somewhere, for example, that a particular train leaves the station at some time, 9 o'clock, 9 p.m. This is the knowledge we have gathered ourselves, and it is a right knowledge also. And someone tells, for example, that I think the time has been recently changed to 7 p.m. The moment someone tells this, what I considered as knowledge initially has become a doubtful notion now. So knowledge is knowledge only if it cannot be shaken by anybody else. And if someone comes and tells that he thinks it is 7 p.m., I should be able to firmly say, no, it is 9 p.m. only. That is correct knowledge. And I should be more sure that it is not 7 p.m. also. That also should be known very firmly. So I should know the truth as truth, and also the untruth or non-truth as non-truth. Until then, the non-truth can masquerade as truth sometimes later. Therefore, Vedantic study involves two stages. One is seeing Vedantic teaching as correct, that is number one, and two, seeing other teachings as defective as or incorrect. Okay, then why can't we accept everything as correct? Because we don't have to displease anyone. So there is no fight at all. Accept everything, no problem. Vedanta is also right. Tarka Shastram is right, Mimamsa is right, Yoga Shastra is right, everything can be right. What is the problem? Why can't we be broad-minded and accept all of them as right? If we ask that question, for that we will ask a question back. For example, if we ask someone, what is 2 plus 2? Student has written 4, and another one has written 3, another one has written 5. Now, can the teacher be broad-minded and accept all these answers? There can be only one correct answer. If such a teacher is there, perhaps, then we can imagine the students how they will be coming out. Remember, the opinions can be many varieties, no problem. But when we discuss about a fact, we cannot have varieties of facts. There is only one fact. Rope is a rope alone. It cannot be a snake. A snake is a snake alone. It cannot be a rope. And the ultimate truth cannot be both Advaitam and Dvaitam. It has to be either Dvaitam or Advaitam, because that is the ultimate truth. If you accept ultimate, the truth as Advaitam, then Dvaitam has to be negated. And if you accept Dvaitam as ultimate, then Advaitam has to be negated. And so, through Vedanta Shravanam, I know the teaching of Vedanta. And through Mananam, I analyze the systems which say other than Vedanta and see whether they can be accepted or not. That is the exercise through Manana. And this problem is more in the case of Vedanta, because for a beginner, it is very difficult to accept whatever Vedanta teaches. It is very, very difficult for a beginner because Vedanta is mind-boggling. It tells something contrary to whatever idea I have been having since birth. In fact, Vedanta makes statements regarding three fundamental things. If you really look at them, it makes statements about the Jiva, it makes statements about the world, the Jagat, and then Ishvara. All these things I cannot swallow, whatever it says. Vedanta says, first what it says, you, the Jiva, are infinite. That's what it says. At least we may be okay, perhaps, because we don't understand what is infinite. If you understand what is infinite, we will immediately discount that. If you don't understand, we may perhaps live with that. But if we say that you are Ananda Swarupaha, immediately we will say, you are telling about somebody else or what? Definitely it is not me, because I am always in problems. I have sorrow, tears, this problem, that problem, all. So what Vedanta tells about Jiva, I cannot accept. It says, I am immortal. I know I am aging. I can see. All the gray hairs have come. I cannot accept that at all. Then it makes a statement about the world. It is even more this thing, which is even more unacceptable. What is that? It says the world is unreal. Vedanta says the world is unreal, which I am solidly facing all the time. I am handling the world clearly every day. This wonderful universe, this solid universe, I am in experience with it every moment, which is looming large in front of me all the time. How can ever I dismiss the world as unreal? So the second statement is even more unacceptable than the first. And the third statement that the Vedanta makes is what? You are not different from the Lord. You and the Lord are same. That is the height of it. This I cannot comprehend at all, because I have heard that the Lord is Sarvajnaha, Sarvashaktiman, Sarveshwaraha, Sarvavyapi, all that. And I know who I am. I am Alpajnaha, Alpashaktiman, real miserable creature. That's what I think. God is omniscient. Swami Dayananda Saraswati says, I don't know even the spelling of omniscience. How can I be same like the Lord? Therefore, how I can, of all people, be identical with the Lord? That is the third problem. So we always take Vedanta with lot of pinches of salt. That is why many people take Vedanta for some class, academic purpose. Okay, let me also spend some time in Vedanta. And for Vyavahara purposes, practical purposes, they take another philosophy. It is like having one pair of slippers for use inside the house and another pair of slippers for going outside. And when one is in real despair, problem, the other systems, they come very handy and they seem to be very easily swallowable. And all the other systems, they say, you are just a mortal. You are not Brahman at all. They say, Jivatmas are many. Jivatma is Jivatma and Paramatma is Paramatma. Jivatma cannot be Paramatma and vice versa. They are all nice to hear. This is what I have been thinking, and they are also telling the same thing. I think that makes sense. That is the conclusion I make. Not only that, they say that the world is solidly real. They also make the statement, world is real. Jagat Satyameva. That is their argument. And we are seeing it all around also. Is it not true? The world is true only, that is what we conclude, because we see it. Pratyaksha Pramanam, that's what we think. Except Advaita, all other darshanas are like this only. And we will feel that we can change our party also. Why should cling on to Advaita, which I do not understand, when all other darshanas, they seem to be so meaningful? That is what one day I will think, and I will say also, maybe why not switch? We can go to the Lord and tell him that you are everything. I have nothing. I am too small. You have to only save me. All that I can go and it is very comfortable. I can cry in front of the Lord for hours. He is not going to say time is up. You can give a big list of all your wishes, grievances, everything to him. So all other systems are very appealing to the intellect. Not only that, there is another thing also about all other darshanas, which is even more appealing. That is, they all claim that they are rational systems. Logical and rational systems. Based on law, they got reasoning, they got logic. So they are all called the Tarka Pradhana Shastras, which are all based on all these logic and all. So Sankhya philosophy is Tarka Pradhana, Yoga, Nyaya, Vaisheshika, Jaina, Bauddha, all are Tarka Pradhana Shastras. Tarka means what? Reasoning, logic. That is what's Tarka. Whereas we Advaitins, what do we claim? We are all Shruti Pramana, Vedasadi Pramanam, no Tarka, no none of those things. Our philosophy is based on Shruti, the Vedas, and we have kept Tarka as a tool for as subsidiary to Vedanta. And that is why in the Sadhana Chatushtaya Sampratti itself, we say Shraddha or faith in the Shruti is a must. Shraddha is must. We should have faith in the scriptures. Whereas a rational person will never talk about faith. A scientist will never talk about faith at all. The moment you utter the word faith, he will say you are illogical. He will say that those who hold on to faith, belief, etc. are weak people. They don't have intellectual capacity at all. That is what all these Tarka experts, scientists, all those people will say. Therefore, they tease the Advaitin Jivan as superstitious people who believe only on the Shruti, holding on to some scriptures. Whereas we believe only in whatever that is logically provable. So all the Tarka people, that's what they say. So even if the Shruti were to say, we will put that also in the text, in the context of Tarka only. For them, Shruti is subsidiary to Tarka. That is what they will argue. For them, the order is reason, always reasoning. And then scripture, first is reasoning and then only scriptures. And for the Vedantin, it is the scripture first and then only reason. And when we hear such statements from them, we tend to think that that is the right thing to do also. Reason first and put the scriptures next. Especially when we are born and brought in an environment of science and technology, especially the modern day technology. And once we start to doubt the Vedantic teaching, then we will find that whatever knowledge we gather is not strong enough. It will become the opinion of Adi Shankara or Vyasacharya. It will not be a knowledge for me. That is what I will conclude. And so what is required is a thorough analysis of those systems which claim superiority. So they are all, we first said they are all wrong philosophies, but we should have a thorough knowledge of them before we conclude that they are wrong. And that is called manan. This is done through this mananam, this exercise, in which every other system is clearly weighed. And the beauty is, when we are studying those systems, we cannot take the help of what? Shruti, Vedas. When we are studying, because they discounted Vedas. You cannot say Veda is Pramana, Veda is telling this, so you are illogical. You cannot tell them, because they have discounted Vedas. Because they don't give importance to Vedas at all. What is important for them is logic. So I cannot take the help of Vedas very much to disprove them, but we have to analyze all those systems with the measuring rod of logic only. So use logic and analyze all those systems and negate them through logic only. And that means we should be strong in logic also to analyze all those logical systems, which are apparently logical systems. We should be strong enough in logic. That is why all Advaita Acharyas are all great logicians also. Great in logic also. In fact, they are so strong that analyzing each system, they point out the logical loopholes. They analyze them very clearly. In those logical systems, what are the loopholes? They analyze and bring them out separately. Shankaracharya analyzes threadbare in his Brahmasutra Bhashya, a special chapter dedicated exclusively for that. The second chapter of Brahmasutra, where every system is analyzed and shown the various contradictions which are in those systems, logically. Having dismissed all those systems, Shankaracharya clearly establishes that logic cannot be used in the discovery of reality. Because logic has got intrinsic limitations. Logic means what? Science included also. Logic means science, modern science, all those things. So the Advaiti, he boldly declares that none of them are competent to reveal the absolute truth. So Shankaracharya establishes the deficiencies of logic by using what? Logic itself. by using law. So that means Swamiji says he is making logic to commit suicide. That's what he says. Shruti also says the same thing. But if I call Shruti, then you won't accept. So I am proving by logic itself. That's what his contention is. So, but Shruti itself has told this thing long, long ago. We don't have to now invent something to disprove that through logic. So, Naisha Tarkena Matirapaneyam Proktam Anyenaivam Sujnanaya Preshta. This we already saw it in Kathopanishad lectures. So Aniyan Hi Tarkam Anupramana. So that we saw these things there at that time. So Shruti itself has talked about the limitation of Tarkam by using the word Atarkyaha Atma. Atarkyaha. It's not, cannot be proved by Tarka. And this logical refutation of other systems and seeing the innate deficiency of logic alone will increase our faith in Vedanta. Because we are logical based people. Therefore, this is the second job called Mananam given in the second line of the shloka. All these things are all to explain the second line of the shloka. Dustarkat suviramyatam. That's what he says. May you get away from all those systems, dustarkad, which are all purely logic based. Viramyatam means move away, get away from all of them. Dustarkam. Dustarkam means what? Kevala tarkam. Shruti rahita tarkam. The ones which are without Vedas, without scriptures, scriptural basis. And this is called manana. Then we can have a doubt perhaps. If logic is deficient and cannot reveal the truth, then does it mean logic should not be followed at all, should be totally given up? Somebody may ask that question. Shankaracharya says, I don't say like that. Logic need not be totally given up. Logic can be used for understanding the Vedantic teaching as subservient to Vedantic teaching. You can take the help of logic to some extent as a tool to extract the meaning of Shastras. So he is not negating logic altogether. You can make use of it as a subsidiary science to understand, to extract the meaning of the mantras. Don't use logic to invent a new philosophy, but use it to bring out the teaching of the Shastras. This is Shrutimatastarkaha. This is called Shrutimatastarkaha, subservient to, assistant to the Vedas. This Tarka. Because for all questions and doubts, Vedas do not give explicit answers. That we know very well. But at the same time, answers are hidden in the Vedas. They are all there in the Vedas. For any question, there are answers. Starting from, for example, if Advaitam is truth, why are we seeing Dvaitam in the real world? For every question, Veda contains the answer. But not explicitly, but implicitly. Therefore, what should we do? We have to extract the answer, bring out the answer to remove any particular doubt that one can have. And what is the method of bringing out the answer? Logic will be useful to bring out the implicit answer. So logic subservient to Vedas, the Shruti, must be accepted not by itself. That is why Shruti itself says, Shrotavyaha Mantavyaha Nididhyasitavyaha. It says, Shrotavyaha means Shruti Pradana. Shrotavyaha means Shruti Pradana. Shruti is Vedas. And Mantavyaha means Tarka supported Shruti. Shruti which is supported by logic. And this should also be followed. Anusandhiyatam. Anusandhiyatam. May you dwell upon. May you repeatedly see this. And that is why many systems of philosophy, they were not there during Shankara's time. And so Shankaracharya never discussed or refuted those systems at that time. But the later Acharyas who came were able to find answers to those questions. They have not invented new answers, but they have only unearthed the answers from the very same Vedantic teaching. Suppose a new theory of relativity comes and relativity based question comes. We don't bother. For that also, there will be an answer, but we have to put some effort to put it in the proper language. For that, we have to put some thinking, look at the Vedantic teaching, remodel it, and then knock off the doubts. All those things has to be done. That is why endless books are coming in Vedanta, because endless intellects are there raising endless questions. So that's what is happening. So many books are also coming. How the answers are given? Not the Shankaracharya or Veda has discussed all of them. But any question is asked by rearranging the Vedic teaching. The answer can be found. So thus answering all my doubts in Manana. During Mananam, all doubts are answered. So, the benefit of Mananam is what? Is conviction in Vedantic teaching. That is Mananam. Shravanam gives knowledge. Mananam gives conviction. And thereafterwards, if other people accept Vedanta or not, I don't care. I am doubly sure about what I have understood. That is the conviction. I can say, Aham Brahmasmi, without any vagueness. Someone says, it is as clear as a person saying, I am a man or woman. Let the whole world call me a donkey or a monkey, doesn't matter. Do I get an iota of doubt that I am a man? No. Will I check in the mirror to see whether I am a man or a monkey or a donkey because someone called me so? I don't have any doubt at all. I may be upset because somebody called me that. But even if I am upset, I don't have any doubt about whom I am. Just as a man has no doubt that he is a man, similarly, I have no doubt about my knowledge. Aham Brahma Asmi. Let the whole world call me against me. Just as the scientist Galileo, who discovered that it is not the sun which goes around the earth, but the earth that goes around the sun. I think he was even tortured, I guess, for that. But he could not change because for him that is firm knowledge. Actually, the church may be against him. I think they accepted a few years ago, I guess, that Galileo is gone. Whatever something has happened, after he was gone, they accepted the truth also. He never had any doubt. So let the whole world persecute him, kill, whatever. But Aham Brahmasmi is the knowledge for me, therefore I do not care. I am so established in that knowledge. So a knowledge which is conviction alone will be useful in Vyavahara. So a doubtful knowledge will never be useful at all. Therefore, Shravanam, Shravanena, Ajnana Nivrittihi. Ajnana, ignorance goes away by Shravanam. And Mananena, Samshaya Nivrittihi. The doubts, Samshayas, they go away by Mananam. So Shravanam removes ignorance, Mananam removes doubts. Now comes the third and the final stage of sadhana, that is Nididhyasana. What is the role of Nididhyasana? It is a process by which the knowledge has to be converted to mental, emotional or psychological strength. Because the reason is this. Our original disease is what? Our original disease is ignorance. And ignorance is purely at the level of intellect. It's a problem of the intellect. But even though the disease is at the intellectual level, the symptoms are expressed at the level of the mind in the form of raga, dvesha, kama, krodha, lobha, moha, matsaryas, bhayam, fear, udvega, all those things, reactions. So, in fact, all the samsara problems are at what level? At the mind level only, emotional level. I am irritated, I am anxious, I am frustrated, I am jealous, I feel deserted, no one cares for me. All these things, I feel lonely. All these are emotional expressions or symptoms. But the root is what? Root is at the intellect. So when we look for the solution, initially the solution is at the intellectual level. Ignorance should go. But that is not enough. What is the use of saying, Aham Brahma Asmi, crying? I cannot be crying and also saying, I am Aham Brahma Asmi. Is this not enough that I am convinced, Aham Brahma Asmi? I have to ask the question whether those emotional symptoms of fear, etc. are completely rooted out of me. As long as they are not gone, knowledge is as good as no knowledge. So, in Tamil there is a saying, Yettu Churakka Karikku Odavadu. Whatever you know, as of a particular the snake good or something, that the knowledge of that will not make you a vegetable. You have to have the actual vegetable to make a sabji or whatever. And that is why people also tease us. What they say, you are going to Vedanta classes, you are studying Bhagavad Gita. What use of going to Gita and Upanishad classes? You are as you were with no change. Now also you do the same thing. If there is a slight salt, some more salt in whatever food we are eating, that's a marsambar. Then what happens many times? Of course, I'm not telling about today here. Earlier, at least we know, the moment there is some excess salt in this thing, the plate will fly. Slightly less sugar, coffee cup will be a missile. People do all these things. And when looking the notes of the previous class or listening to the tapes, what one really looks at, what one wants, why one should have Vedanta class at all? They will ask all these questions. Therefore, a Vedanta which does not help me to develop a sane mind, a calm mind, a compassionate mind, a loving mind, a considerate mind, a generous mind, charitable person, strong, non-reacting mind. If it is not helping me to develop any of these, what is the use of that Vedanta to me? That Vedanta is utterly useless to me. And this is called assimilation of the teaching. Once the teaching is assimilated, then a person will be whatever I just described, all those things. So by assimilation, what do we mean? A knowledge coming at the emotional level as emotional strength, as emotional duty, emotional refinement. That's how that knowledge should be reflected on. And that is called Jivan Mukti. A person who has that knowledge, that is why Krishna describes Jivan Mukta as what? Dukkesh Dukkeshum Anudvignamanaha. Knowledge is at the intellectual level, but the benefit is at the emotional level. As what? Dukkeshu Anudvignamanaha. When provoking situations come, Dukkam comes, he is able to remain calm. Anudvignam. Anudvignam means without getting perturbed. Sukeshu Vigataspruhaha. When things are going well, Sukeshu, he does not get totally lost in them, not totally elated, jumping up and down. Vitaraga Bayakrodaha. There is no clinging to anything for such a person. I am ready to give up anything at any time. This is called Vitaragaha. Ragaha is attachment. I am ready to give up anything at any time. Similarly, Vita Bayaha, Vita Krodaha. I can give up krodha, bhayam, all that. The only difference is what? In the case of food that we eat, assimilation is a natural process. When we eat food, assimilation happens. We don't have to do anything. It will get assimilated. How do we know? Because we get hungry again. You take food now, get hungry again. If it remains like Brahman, Brahman is, you know, ever there. If it remains like Brahman without any change, then we can take food only once, then it will remain forever. No question of hunger or thirst or anything lifelong. So it is digested, get absorbed in the body. That is why after 4 or 5 hours, the stomach makes all kinds of sounds and becomes hungry. Therefore, in the case of food, assimilation is a natural process. But in the case of Vedanta, assimilation is not a natural process. It requires independent effort. One has to put a lot of effort. I have to spend time. I have to take every emotional weakness. I have to bring Vedantic teaching to address all of them. And each weakness has to be removed. It is a painful, very long, time-consuming process. In fact, it is a lifelong job perhaps. Initially, I can knock off small things. I don't get angry for small things initially. Now I get angry towards bigger things. So it is a lifelong process of taking up every emotional issue and consciously knocking each one of them off. And every individual has got his own weakness. For one, superiority complex is his weakness. For the other, inferiority complex is his weakness. For one, fear is the weakness. For the other, guilt is a weakness. Therefore, one has to bring out each one and consciously knock off and see, I am guilt-free, I am fear-free, I am irritation-free, I am reaction-free. This is called Nididhyasanam, and it requires separate time and constant alertness. One has to be constantly alert. We should not be doing something else and doing this also. We have to allocate a committed time for this analysis of ourselves. We have to ask, how am I? How I am today compared to what I was yesterday? Or this situation could have been dealt with differently at all or not? All those inquiries, analysis, we have to do of ourselves. And we have to be alert in our day-to-day vyavaharas and see which are the weaknesses that are really coming up and then obstructing my growth spiritually. That means what? Introspection is involved. We have to introspect ourselves. Where are the instances I had a Vedantic response? So all these, they come out at the time of introspection of ourselves. Then the next morning, you have to auto-suggest. Introspection is done the previous night. Next morning when you get up, we have to make an auto-suggestion. What we should say, oh, this and situations could have been dealt with differently. So today, if those things arise, I am going to deal with them differently. I am going to keep calm. I'm not going to get angry. I am going to deal with them in this manner. I have to be alert with respect to these responses, all these responses. Then it will become lesser and lesser introspection every day. Again, auto-suggestions also will become less and less. And that is said here, Aham Brahma Asmi Iti Vibhavyatam. May you repeatedly dwell upon the teaching that I am Brahman. Brahman means what? The primary illuminator and not the secondary illuminator. We have already used these expressions, I guess, earlier in some other lectures. That is an intellectual thing that I use, but I am not that. It is an intellectual thing I use. I am not that. Iti Vibhavyatam. Vibhavyatam means Vibhavana means what? Meditation. Here it is meditation in passive voice. Vibhavyatam. Not only Aham Brahmasmi is to be brought to the mind positively, and there is the negative side also. That is, I am not the Ahankara, I am not the Stula Shariram, I am not the Sukshma Shariram, I am not any one of them. So, what I am and what I am not. I am the Atma. I am not any of this body. I am not Anatma. Both should be seen. I should know I am Atma. I should also know I am not this body. That means what? I must be able to see my own body as one of the objects in the world. You know, what a strange thing. I can see the body of everybody else as an object, as different from me. But I should be able to see my own body also as an object in the world. How do I know? Whether I have got the same objectivity like any other body, how do I know? When we read the obituary column, what we do? We just say, oh, poor man is gone. As a nice man is gone. And the next moment, we are all on with our vyavaharas. Forgotten with the coffee. All those things. You know, you take coffee, read the newspaper and read the obituary. And once the coffee is done, newspaper is done, that's forgotten. In fact, we'll also say, all those who are born, we will be philosophical also. All those who are born have to die one day anyway. And after learning Gita, we also know the quotation, Jatasya hi dhruva mrityuhu. All that thing we know. That means that is the objectivity. Do I have the same objectivity with respect to this body also? You know, in Kashi, when somebody dies, they always take the body. In the street they are going. Ram Nam Satya Hai, they recite and take the body. And the bystander, he looks at it. Oh, he says, oh, what a thing, this man died. The greatest vichitram is he thinks that he is going to be permanent. That is the greatest vichitra. So that means what? The objectivity. If I have got the same objectivity, that means the knowledge is sturdy and firm. Same objectivity about my own body. If I have, so similarly with respect to everything. We are only taking here an example, but similarly with respect to everything. So we should be able to take the body as a wave appearing, dashing about and dashing to pieces ultimately. As a wave. This body also should be taken in that manner. People carry, some people cry, or many people may be happy also perhaps somebody is gone. All those things are there. They are only natural because that is the law of creation. It is a fact. You cannot resist it. It is a fact only. Can I meditate upon the death of this body without disturbance? If I can do that without disturbance, that means maturity has come. Oh, this body also is going to go one day without any disturbance, no problem at all. Oh, it will go. What is it? Is I am aging, it will die one day also. So that's so what? Once I have that kind of an attitude, that means maturity is coming. Now, what is the situation? We talk about all those now, they are all amangalam, right? When people talk about death and all, we immediately say they are all amangalam. Why you talk about those things? Let us talk about all auspicious things, all mangalam things. So that is, there is no amangalam or amangalam, nothing like that at all. Fact is a fact. Where is mangalam and amangalam when it comes to fact? By closing the eyes, the fact cannot be erased, right? Like the cat trying to make the entire world dark by closing its own eyes. So I should be able to accept all facts objectively. That is called maturity. So Shankaracharya, he says both. Aham brahmasmi iti vibhavyatam. And in the fourth line, he says, dehe aham matihi ujjatam. We have to read actually both together, both the lines together. Ujjata means may be given up. But what should be given up? I am the body. That notion should be given up. So cultivate I am Brahman knowledge and reject I am body notion. That's what he says both. And this is Nididhyasana. This is for the rest of the life, not for that moment. It should be there for the rest of the life. There is no time limit for this at all. All the time I should be in Nididhyasana only. When I get some time, I consciously do that. All the time it should be there, but when I get some time, I should consciously do that. If I don't have time, I try to be alert in my day-to-day transactions. All the transactions, I should be alert. And here afterwards, Shankaracharya, he is going to give some instructions with respect to our day-to-day living. After Shravanam and Mananam discussion, he is going to give some instructions about our day-to-day living, which are conducive to Nididhyasana, to the assimilation of Vedantic teaching. So when Shankaracharya gives, he is keeping in mind the sannyasi. That's what he does. So because in the previous shloka, he has talked about Brahmacharya Ashrama and Grahastha Ashrama. So Nijagrahat Turnam Vinirgamyatam. We saw that. He spoke about Vanaprastha Ashrama also. All these. So Dridataram Karmasu Santyajyatam. He spoke about Sannyasa Ashrama also. So he is now trying to, you know, imagine a person who has passed these stages. Brahmacharya Ashrama, Grahastha Ashrama, Vanaprastha Ashrama, Sannyasa also, who is a sannyasi now. So some of the instructions may not be relevant to a Grahastha. So we may have to modify a bit and take the instructions only. So some of the instructions are common to both Grahastha and Sannyasi. So what are the instructions he is going to give? So we have to see that thing in the context now. So having discussed the Shravanam and Mananam, Mananam part of the Jnana Yoga. Let us say, now Shankaracharya is going to discuss Nididhyasanam, as we said, which is meant for what? Which is meant for the assimilation of that knowledge, and which is meant to convert the knowledge into an emotional strength, which is meant for Jnana Nishtha. So, and Nididhyasanam is of two types also. One is withdrawing from all vivaharas and consciously dwelling upon the various aspects of the teaching, which are relevant for me. It is a sitting meditation which depends on my personality. And the second one is what? The other most important type of Nididhyasana is being always alert in my day-to-day transactions, in my responses to various situations, in that, so in the language that I am, that I use in my transactions. And I make sure that all my transactions are in keeping with what? With Vedantic teaching. All my transactions are. And they are not contrary to Vedantic teaching. Most important. So this alert life itself is Nididhyasanam, which is as important as the sitting Nididhyasanam. So one can sit and do Nididhyasanam, meditate. Or every moment of life, one can convert into Nididhyasanam. So it is not confined to any particular time. It is all through my waking hours. And when a person takes Nididhyasanam, certain points Shankaracharya wants him to note, certain instructions he gives. That's what we are going to see. So even though those instructions are to be followed even before I come to Jnanam, these are all values to be followed even before coming to Jnana Yoga and to be followed even after gaining Jnanam also. These are all values. The only difference is what? I follow them for Jnanam. Later, I follow them for nishta. That is the only difference, to establish myself in the knowledge. And first instruction that Shankaracharya gives is garva parityajyatam. Let not the knowledge go to your head and create a superiority complex. Keep the head on your shoulders only. Don't keep the head into the clouds. Don't claim I am a jnani. Bring me garlands. Do pada puja. Do namaskara. Never have such attitudes at all. Be humble. Which has been given as a value of amanitvam before. Amanitvam, adambitvam, ahimsa, shantihi, arjavam. So that's what Krishna said. So same thing is repeated here. And the next instruction he gives is, in the last class we already introduced this, vadaha parityajyatam. May you give up arguments, vadaha, with anyone, especially with wise people. Because argument can boast or it can fatten the ego. And also we lose the opportunity of learning from wise people by arguing with them. Of course, here we have to make a subtle distinction between vada and samvada. Swamiji makes a nice distinction. In Bhagavad Gita, we say Krishna Arjuna Samvade at the end of every chapter. Srimad Bhagavad Gita, Su Upanishadsu, Brahma Vidyayam, Yoga Shastre, Sri Krishna Arjuna Samvade. It is Samvada. That is the student asking question to the teacher for clarification, for learning. That is called Samvadaha. Here Shankaracharya is not dismissing Samvadaha, but dismissing Vadaha, argument. How do I know whether I have Samvada with my teacher or Vada with my teacher? How do I distinguish? Perhaps in the name of Samvada, I may be doing Vada only. In what way these two are different? Somebody might ask. And there are many differences between Vada, arguing, and Samvada, questioning, for clarification. So some of the basic things that we can just look at them. First point is, when I want to argue with someone, I look upon that person as equal to me or inferior to me when I want to pick up an argument. Whereas in Samvada, I don't look upon my teacher as equal or inferior, but as superior to me in knowledge, maturity, in all aspects. So there is a basic difference in the attitude. And this attitude expresses in the very language I use. How I address the other person will indicate whether I treat him as superior or inferior. The way of addressing indicates the attitude. And the language, the decency, the dignity indicates my attitude again. The tone indicates my attitude. I never raise my voice in front of my teacher. In argument, many times we try to win over by doing what? By raising the voice, which never happens in a samvada. So there is a basic difference in the attitude indicated by the type of address, language, and tone of speech. That's number one. And number two, often when I enter into an argument, I have made my conclusion on a topic. That is the preamble. And through argument, I want to establish my conclusion or refute the other. That is my aim. I try to corner him one way or the other in an argument. Whereas in a student's approach, the student may have some opinion or notion, but he never made a conclusion. And his aim is what? Is not to establish his conclusion or refute the teacher's conclusion or teaching, but he wants to learn. He is open-minded, such a person. So put it simply, in one, the mind is closed in the vadi, because conclusion is already made. And in the other, in the samvadi, the mind is open because no conclusion is made. The student might have made some observations, but not conclusions. And I'm always ready to accept that I may be wrong. This is the second difference between vada and samvada. And the third one, in arguments, I try to talk more and almost don't allow the other person to talk at all. Keep on talking. And if the other person talks, I don't listen also, because I am thinking of my next argument. Because argument. And I interfere before he has even concluded. I don't let him complete any sentence. I don't allow him to talk. And even if he talks, I don't listen. And I interfere when he talks. This is argument. Whereas a student talks, he talks the minute he wants to put his idea in the briefest possible manner to the teacher. And he allows the teacher to talk more and more, and he listens with 200% attention, never interferes. And even if after the teacher has stopped, he gives a few more minutes gap. Perhaps the teacher might want to add some more points. So he gives time. Till that time, he does not open his mouth. Then if you ask to tell something, again he talks very less only. And as a corollary, we can also get one more thing here. In arguments, since I have not listened to the other person, I have nothing to reflect upon later. Because I never gave an opportunity to listen to him. I keep on talking only. So I have nothing to reflect later. Whereas when I listen in a samvada with the teacher, not only I listen, I work on whatever I have listened later. I reflect upon that learning. When I have what I have listened, giving maximum respect to the thought of the teacher. This is the third point. And the fourth, one more point also is, there is a possibility, even after elaborate answering, I am not convinced that is possible. Not that I can accept whatever he says, the teacher says straight away. And politely, I ask once more. And I again ask once more. He elaborates again. Once I have asked it twice and I am not convinced, I respectfully put an end to further questioning and humbly say, I will think over the answer given by you. I don't discount saying that he is not correct or he is not clear. I will say, I will spend time. And I spend time, and after giving some more thought, after some time, I come again and raise the question. But after independently reflecting upon the answer many times, I work on it, sincerely try to receive and assimilate the answer. If it is still not clear, I can ask again. But in an argument, the problem is grinding repeatedly, arguing the same thing, almost, you know, ad nauseam, and finally give up. And one more last point that we can make. After samvada, there is no disturbance or bitterness in the mind. Most important. But in an argument, there is always disturbance, there is always bitterness in the mind. So there is a gulf of differences between a student asking a question to the teacher, which is welcome always, it is part of learning, and there is a lot of difference trying to argue with a Mahatma and try to question him, let me find out how much he knows, and try to give something, you know, oh, that person said like this, all that thing they make. Argument is positively condemned in our scriptures. Asking questions for clarification is always encouraged in the scriptures. And therefore, samvadaha kriyatam, vadaha parityajyatam. Do samvada always, but vada argument, you please give up. That's what Shankaracharya says in the shloka, and we'll take up the next shloka in the next webinar. Yo veda dausvara prokto vedante cha pratishtitaha tasya prakriti leenasya parasamaheshwara sri krishna arpanamastu.